Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast, the bi-weekly show from London's home of big thinking. I'm Vas Christodoulou. How do blind spots cloud your judgment and distort your self-perception? Our guest on this episode, Emma Reid Terrell, is a psychotherapist and the co-host of the hit podcast Best Friend Therapy. The other co-host is her best friend, Elizabeth Day. She's also the author of a new book called What Am I Missing? It's a guide to uncovering and challenging the blind spots that commonly show up in daily life. She was joined by her fellow therapist and author, Kate Moyle, for a live-streamed conversation that will help you understand yourself better, and other people too. Enjoy.
Emma, you have been a psychotherapist for 15 years, and your first book was all about people-pleasing. People-pleasing was such a big thing and is such a big thing, something we know that so many people struggle with, that they're kind of putting everyone else's needs way before their own. But blind spots, I'm assuming, is something else that you have found coming up again and again in your practice. And I'd love to know, or for us to kind of kick this off with, why the book about blind spots? What is it that's so important about them? Do we all have them? And what is it that made you think, okay, that's what this next book needs to be about?
When I wrote Please Yourself, it was because it was just everywhere, swarms of people struggling with how to live a life intentionally without having an impact on anybody, without inconveniencing anybody, without upsetting anybody. And so there was this urge for me to write something that was going to speak to that. Fast forward 3 years, and there was suddenly a different conversation in my therapy room. So many more people had done some of the work, a lot of the work on themselves. They knew what they knew. They had a really clear idea of some of the areas that they struggled with, for example, people pleasing. But even after all of that self-reflection and personal development work, there was still something missing. There was this block. And the language, you're absolutely right. This became a kind of vernacular of the therapy room. Like, I don't get it, Emma. What am I missing? I always have the problem with my boss where he promotes somebody else over me. I go home and I have the same argument with my partner. I go back to see my parents and I become a grumpy teenager again. I am a grown adult who knows a lot. There was a lot of insight in the therapy room. And yet there was this sense of, okay, there is something that's an unknown. And that's where this idea of psychological blind spots came in.
Is the unknown unknown? Is that us feeling stuck? Like, stuck is a phrase, I think, as a therapist that I hear all the time and I'm seeing people describing that they're feeling.
Yeah.
Is that, would you describe an unknown unknown as that feeling of stuckness or kind of not knowing where to turn, what to do next, whether to go backwards, forwards, sideways?
Yeah. And in a way, stuck feels like a kind of a known unknown. There's something even in stuck that's like, ah, I'm spinning my wheels and getting nowhere, or I'm trying different things and it's not seeming to unstick me, or I'm overwhelmed and I don't know why. It's like there's a feeling, a sensation that someone's aware of. When I went even deeper into the kind of blind spots, it was, yeah, I don't even know what I'm missing. As far as I know, I'm doing everything right. I shouldn't be stuck. This was a kind of a level below that that said, well, let's have a look in your peripheral vision and just scan a bit around the corners and see what we might not have noticed that you don't know yet.
So that means that a blind spot is something very different to avoidance, which is a kind of more active, you know, not always necessarily a choice, but definitely a strategy for us managing whatever's going on for us.
Yeah, exactly. I think avoidance is one of the ways that we can preserve a blind spot. So the blind spot is the bit we don't know about ourselves, but avoidance, dismissal, minimizing, normalizing, all of those other really smart tactics that we can use to kind of stay comfortable. They're the tips and techniques and tools we've developed to actually preserve the blind spot and keep it hidden.
Okay, because you describe blind spots, you say it's human nature for our brains to create blind spots. And so then if that's the human nature, and that I assume means we all have them?
I think so, although maybe, you know, on day dot we don't, but I think we very quickly develop blind spots. I think there's something about how our brain, and I talk about this with clients a lot, I think it's hard for us to accept that our brain's not really interested in us being happy. It's interested in us surviving. So when we put that into a blind spot context, what we're actually saying is, if your brain has early on worked out that this path leads to safety and survival, it will continue to choose that path for you, even if it leads you to disappointment or frustration or stuckness. So I find it fascinating, this idea that we probably all have got blind spots. And it's a kind of perfect marketing tool for my book, because I say, if you want to know what you're missing, buy the book. If you don't want to know what you're missing, you probably should buy the book. There's something about actually how can we start to look at things with more curiosity to find out what is it that we don't yet understand.
And in my practice, I work primarily with people struggling with sexual and relationship difficulties. I often see that clashing of, I feel really anxious or really stressed about this and I want to pull away, and the thing that I want is the closeness and the connection and the intimacy. And so it's the perfect example for me of those two things kind of coming up against each other, the kind of safety, security, kind of, as you said, the brain doing what it thinks it's meant to do, versus actually what I want is something completely different. But it's often a mistranslation, I think, and that can happen definitely in our psychology, and particularly when we're in periods of really high stress or really high anxiety, because
absolutely
we just are on got to get through this mode in whatever way I think is the most kind of energy efficient way to do that.
Yeah, I totally agree.
And so jumping into blind spots, because obviously the topic of this conversation is discovering our blind spots and how to overcome them. Tell me what your working definition of blind spots is. And then you've created these four profiles, and I'd love you to kind of explore them.
Okay, great. Thank you. What a great opportunity, because this is the bit where I get to say that a blind spot is an area of low or no awareness. And I say low or no because we have to account for the fact that that couple who come to you for psychosexual counselling, one or both may have some awareness. They might have a sense of something that's going on. They might know that what they're looking for is intimacy and what they're doing is pulling away. Or they might have no awareness. They might never get to you because they don't yet know that there's something to be resolved in therapy. So we have this kind of two sides of understanding it. It's low or no awareness. And you're absolutely right that I developed profiles, partly because I grew up in the 90s and just 17 was a Bible. And if you could have a category, so much the better. Because this for me was about actually not how can I dumb it down, how can I make generalizations, but how can I give people access points just in which they can start to understand, this feels a bit familiar. I might be able to build on that awareness and get some more sense of kind of me and my uniqueness. So the four profiles really were about our relationship to needs. I had a big whiteboard in my office, and that's where I started this profile conversation with myself. And it basically started off with profile one. What about those people who, if you ask them what do they need, they'd say, nothing. I don't have any needs. I don't have any emotional needs. I don't have any sexual needs. I don't have any relationship needs. I'm fine. And actually, you know, I can hard relate to that profile because it's the one that I probably grew up being, or at least I started a kind of a portion of my life being. So that profile I called the rock. And the rock is, at least to an outsider, strong, stable, resilient, self-reliant, capable, independent. They don't ask for much. They don't make demands of the world, but not because they don't feel they can, because they don't feel they need anything. In fact, their place is often to help other people. So I see a lot of rocks end up in caring professions, a bit like ours. And there's something about that. Here's as close as I'm going to get to feelings. I'm not going to do my own feelings, but I'm going to get involved in other people's feelings because I know they do matter. So we see a lot of rescuing happening from rocks. We see them being the one that people come to with their problems. They're the ones that have a shoulder to cry on. They sort things out. They're fixers. They're great with solutions. They can be really practical. They don't necessarily make great contact with their vulnerability, at least until they've gone through therapy and trained to become a therapist, and then you start to understand it differently, right?
I don't know what you're talking about, Emma.
I don't know either, right? Honestly, I feel like when I started my psychotherapy training, I entered that room, and now if I could be a fly on the wall, I would be, wow, we're all rocks. We were literally all there with the same intention of kind of understanding feelings as they pertain to someone else. And then, of course, you're dragged into personal therapy, aren't you? And you have to face your demons. But anyway, that's our rock. So what I say the rock is missing is vulnerability. So that's not to say that they don't obviously have those feelings, but that they might not access them. So their vulnerability could quite possibly be in a blind spot. And to your point about avoidance, they will have that down as a way of keeping that blind spot protected. They're the ones who, if you say to them, you know, we could talk about this. Talk about what? They're the ones who you say, like, oh, we could maybe take this into therapy. No, therapy's not for me. Therapy's for other people. There's something that's very defended against that idea of vulnerability.
That we might experience those people as kind of quite defensive, or what we might notice is if we try and approach the vulnerability, and we know where we poke the vulnerable bits, it hurts, right? We know it's sore. That you might experience it from someone as anger or as defensiveness, or them kind of pushing you away emotionally. Is that a strategy we might see those kind of types of people employing?
Definitely. I would probably say that actually we're going to find that most of those profiles will use those sorts of strategies as well. I think what makes the rock even rockier is more of that kind of blank expression, that there's a kind of cool detachment, that they can seem quite aloof. There's nothing to defend. So they don't necessarily become defensive. There's just nothing to see here. The gladiator is our second profile. So I was talking about relationships with needs, where our rock will say, I don't really have anything. I don't need anything. I'm fine. What our gladiator does is recognize they have needs. There are demands they intend to place upon the world, but they don't necessarily intend to do it collaboratively. They don't necessarily have trusting relationships with others. They tend to be someone who, at the emotional buffet of life, goes and fills their plate first and doesn't necessarily account for other people in that room or in that relationship. So they're great at being ambitious leaders. They're great at being determined. They can be very confident. They achieve their goals. They can be very single-minded. They can also come across as a bit cutthroat, as perhaps a bit bombastic, even a bit aggressive. Quite possibly, because there isn't that sense that they can bring someone on the journey with them. So why have a pack if a pack's just going to slow you down, or a pack's going to become a kind of a burden on you? Actually, they can go further, faster as a lone wolf. But it doesn't necessarily mean, of course, that they get all of those relational needs met. I see this profile least often in therapy, and typically they're dragged under duress by a partner as part of couples therapy, or they come to me as a result of a crisis. I've lost my job, something's changed, my partner's left me, there's been this rupture. They don't see it coming because, as far as they're concerned, everybody's getting their needs met. So sometimes I think a gladiator comes to therapy when they've been blindsided by the fact that actually they were happy, but other people weren't.
Okay. I was going to say, when you said that, you were talking about it in the way that it seems like a surprise to that type of person.
Yeah, I think it can be. I mean, I can think about gladiators I've had who would say, but you said you were okay with that. And I wouldn't do something that I wasn't okay with. So I just assumed that you wouldn't do something you weren't okay with. And not recognizing that actually the person they were in a relationship probably wasn't a gladiator.
Okay. So would that be someone who might struggle with empathy or struggle to see things from someone else's perspective?
Yeah, exactly. So when I think about what's missing, what's in their blind spot, empathy is exactly it. It's that piece about being able to step into the existence of someone else and put themselves in their position and really account for the impact that they're having on that person. And think about win-wins and think about how to become greater than the sum of their parts. This is somebody who actually doesn't necessarily have empathy in their toolkit readily. Again, what you see is often someone who has been either parented with an excess of empathy or a complete lack of empathy. So they haven't had a model of empathy from which to learn. Or there's been this excess of empathy that means they've never had to share the space. Things have been always given the way they wanted them. So put them in the big wide world as an adult, and their expectation remains the same.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Marquee TV. Marquee TV is an incredible streaming service that is a gateway to arts and culture. With my subscription, I've enjoyed watching some of the Royal Shakespeare Company's most acclaimed productions of recent years, including David Tennant in Richard II and Simon Russell Beale in The Tempest. I've seen multiple productions of The Ring Cycle and Thelonious Monk playing in Brussels in 1963. I've watched Alice in Wonderland at the Royal Opera House and Giselle at La Scala. Marquee TV really is the most accessible way into culture I've ever encountered, and a treasure trove for any arts lover. You can try it for 3 months for just 99p. Yep, 3 months for 99p with the code HOWTO. Just visit marquee.tv and use the promo code HOWTO to dive into the world of the arts like never before.
So, and then I guess what you're saying is not surprised that those people were not seeing them as much in therapy, because it's, you know, therapy is about kind of acknowledging that and coming and saying, okay, what can we do to change this? Or how do I change this? And there's being about something kind of bringing down onto someone else's level or in line with someone else and someone else's feelings.
Absolutely. And I think gladiators are amazing. And in fact, one of the things that I have tried to do, and I talk to people about this as well, is this starting as a rock. Becoming more gladiator has actually been a really important part of my therapeutic journey, not with the absence of consideration, but with their strengths. Each of these profiles has such strengths. The fact that a gladiator can go into a room and make a demand. I find that kind of so refreshing in the society that we live in.
And I think that's such a good point to make, because I think, you know, we hear this conversation a lot with things like attachment styles, don't we? That kind of people are like, which one's the better one? Which one should I be? Yeah. Which one is the more desirable one? And I think recognizing that there are strengths to all of the different profiles is such a big part of it.
Totally.
I think we sometimes miss the nuances of that conversation. And I know when I've interviewed Stan Tatkin, who is an author who talks a lot about attachment styles before, he said, do you know what? Sometimes I wish I hadn't named them things that people then used against each other. So that I didn't create the terminology for it to kind of be used attackingly between partners. Yes. And I think that it's a really important thing for us to acknowledge when we're talking about profiles.
Absolutely.
It's because, you know, we kind of have one word which fits so many things.
Yeah. And this is where I come back a lot to this idea of becoming greater than the sum of our parts in relationship counselling. Certainly this, I certainly know it's true in my own marriage, and I see it happening time after time that couples come together because each one holds this missing piece of the puzzle. And my husband is certainly not a rock or a gladiator. We'll come on and find out what he is. But he is somebody who I have learned so much from in terms of how to broaden my perspective. So far from kind of fighting each other with the profiles, they've become these kind of really complementary pieces that we can lend each other, that this is how we actually gain, at least in my understanding, perspective. It's my goal for the book is, how can I assimilate all of the awareness and insight that these profiles have so that I have the most perspective? Not that there will be a right decision, but that it will be a really informed one.
Mm-hmm. So knowing more allows you to make more aware or better choices or better decisions, informed decisions. Informed choices is a huge thing we talk about in therapy, isn't it? Helping people to make informed choices. And I suppose it's kind of about knowing better, knowing deeper. So the next profile, are we going to do the bridge or the hustler?
Let's do the hustler. So this is, I love a hustler. The hustler is the most charming, creative, can be very sociable person. They're really agile and dexterous. They're great at negotiating. They can be really spontaneous. They can be really playful. They know they have needs. They know other people can help them get met. What they don't have is the sense of permission or potency around being able to ask what they need directly. So you'll find them in that room at the buffet saying, after you, hoping that that down payment of good behavior will earn them something in return. Or they'll be dropping hints, or they'll be hoping that people mind read them. Or, dare I say it, they'll be consciously or unconsciously manipulating the outcomes of a room, having some sway over the reactions of others that might get those needs met for them without having to stick their head above the parapet and ask for what they want. So hustlers are, and many of my friends are hustlers. They are working hard. They are working really hard. And it's exhausting for them, you know, because there is something, you see a lot of imposter syndrome within a hustler. You see a lot of people pleasing within a hustler. It's tactical. It's what do I become for this person to accept me? Because what they're missing in their blind spot is self-acceptance. The idea that they could actually tolerate rejection, they could withstand criticism, they could survive judgment, they could risk somebody's reaction and find out actually that many of the times they would have been accepted in the first place. But it's their lack of self-acceptance that stops them asking for what they need.
It feels like what you're describing is that those behaviours or those strategies are less direct.
Yeah.
So they're more subtle or more behind the scenes or more, as you said, that kind of hoping. If I do everything right, I hope that will give me the result that I want.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, realistically, can often end up in a bit of a passive-aggressive sting, you know, because that hustler might go to work and they stay late every day and they're always the one that does the overtime and they never say no. And then they want to pick their child up from school or go to sports day or something changes and they put a request in. And when it's turned down for valid reasons, what they're left feeling is, hang on a minute, but I've done all this for you. Except, of course, that contract was never explicit. So sometimes that level of passive aggression that can kick up for a hustler then actually ends up in the negative reaction they've been trying to avoid all that time.
Mm. So it kind of is like an explosion of that.
Yeah, exactly. It's that kind of, I think about transactional analysis because that's my kind of, that's my origin story in terms of theoretical approaches. But that idea of stamp collecting, that idea of like, I'm just going to collect all of these bruises, really, and then I'm going to cash them all in and feel wretched about it. And also I'm going to reinforce this idea that, you see, I couldn't have what I wanted.
Would these people often be people who might describe things being unfair?
Yeah, 100%. That there's a belief in luck and a belief in fairness. So they might consider themselves lucky if something goes right and not actually take the credit for it. Or things might be unfair if they go wrong and they're not taking accountability. But there is something about this idea that they are swept along in the weather of the world, beholden to the behaviour of other people.
I'm so interested in this profile in the context of the modern world we live in, and that currently with technology the way it is and phones being a kind of primary relationships is what lots of psychologists are kind of starting to argue, that everyone's so kind of self and device preoccupied that I wonder if that's pushed the extreme of kind of hustlers' behaviours more because everyone's noticing each other less.
Yeah.
In a kind of daily way, particularly in things like a work environment, and everyone's more self-absorbed and less kind of in-person social. So I'm wondering if lots of those strategies that would have been so previously kind of in person are happening less and less and less, or in a different way, or being noticed less, and if that's actually making things feel a lot harder.
I think you're right. Yeah. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think what I would add to that is that because so much of those relationships have moved online, hustlers are the ones who will suffer most from comparison, competition, feelings of inadequacy. So when we start to compare those external lives that we view on social media with our lived experience, we're going to find that that gap gets even wider and we're going to feel even more isolated and like we have to pedal even harder to catch up. So I think there's a big divide that's happened there for hustlers particularly. Gladiators I don't often see on social media. And I suppose there's something in that as well, that they are not looking for external validation.
And that fits with the idea of them being a kind of more strong solo person. I mean, like a gladiator in an arena.
Yeah, absolutely. That only one can win.
Yeah, they don't need that.
No.
And so then that leads us on
to the bridge. Yes, the bridge. The bridge is my fourth profile. So we've talked about these needs. When we run down that kind of hierarchy of needs, a bridge knows they have needs. A bridge knows they need other people to help meet them. A bridge doesn't feel that they have any influence over whether someone meets those needs or not. So a bridge just accepts things the way they are. There isn't the energy of that hustler to get involved and start to kind of puppeteer or work things from the wings. the bridge tends to be firmly strapped into the passenger seat of life. Typically because that was the option they were given. Growing up, decisions were made for them, or it wasn't safe for them to have a voice. Or they grew up in a system where everybody was a bridge, and that was the norm. So in those situations, what we have is someone who is brilliant at collaborating and cooperating, actually great at listening and communication, really switched on to the needs of other people, flexible, easygoing, relaxed. This is what you would see in your bridge friends. Someone who'll go with the flow, doesn't mind coming to you, is happy to change plans, never says no, but actually never shows up. You might not ever get to really meet that bridge. You might not ever really see what makes them tick, what their preferences are, what their identity is made of. What you hear instead is what's been acceptable to them in the past. So for our bridges, fantastic team players, fantastic in terms of making things work, great mediators, brilliant at generating harmony and peace in situations. Sometimes what they're missing, though, is their own power to be able to have a voice and to be able to state their needs, to be able to have needs in the first place, because that's where the bridge and the rock have something in common. They've just worked out a different way of preserving a different blind spot.
So would these be people who might feel like they want to go for something but don't know how to, or feel like they don't know how to kind of push further, or how to, I don't want to say fulfill their potential, but there's something around, I'm kind of thinking of people who really struggle to kind of get further or push further or have the self-belief to do it, but also actually manage to kind of be able to put that into practice.
Yeah, I think there's a kind of, the energy is lower. So yes, you're right in terms of fulfilling potential because the energy is lower. So whereas I would see more anxiety as a presenting issue in a hustler, I'll typically see more depression presenting in a bridge. That there is something about the belief that actually it's just not for the likes of me. Not with that it's not fair energy, but just this is how the world is. Much less of a fight, much less of a sense that they have anything that they can use to protect or change their situation. And for lots of people, they live as a bridge happily because they have responsible, loving parents. They have partners who make sure that they are front and center in the family that they create. But of course, it does leave them very exposed and at risk of somebody less well-behaved. Somebody who actually abuses the fact that a bridge will take things as they're presented to them. So quite often I see a bridge come into couples therapy, and it might not be the bridge that started the conversation. But what we start to understand is, I'm not sure this is a healthy relationship for you either. And so as their voice gets louder, sometimes we end up having a very different therapeutic conversation to the one that their partner brought them into therapy for.
And when we think about these profiles, I've noticed that you're kind of mentioning in particular about couples therapy a bit as well. When we're thinking about compatibility or incompatibility, is that something that you see between the profiles, or are there ways that they all differently kind of work together? And I'm thinking not just for people in relationships, but people who are dating or people who are single, and thinking about, you know, the kind of type of person that they might want to date or starting a new relationship. I guess I really want to make sure that we don't kind of just center the conversation around couples and people in relationships, but there's all these different factors about trying to understand each other and work out like how we work together. And we know relationships are some of the biggest work that we'll ever do. But is there, you know, and often we talk about in attachment styles that there might be kind of pairings that are more common or that we yes. see more often or we see working more often. Is that something that you see with these profiles or not really?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's kind of those two separate things, aren't there's something about compatibility. Do I think that certain profiles are more compatible with others? No, if they're en route to perspective, if they're looking to grow into who they're going to become rather than what's brought them to where they are. Do I see pairings more often? Absolutely. And I think this is one of the things that's so interesting is that a bit like with attachment styles, and of course, if you have an understanding of attachment styles, you can see how those overlay in some of these profiles too. But there is something about how a rock or a gladiator is quite often in a relationship with a bridge or a hustler. Bring back my husband's stage right. There is something about how he is a bridge hustler, or as I like to call him, a bristle. And I am a kind of rocky gladiator, a radiator, if you will. And that combination is quite common, that there's one who has this kind of higher focus on others and one who has a lower focus on others, one who has a higher energy and one who has a lower energy. And actually in the book, one of the things I draw out as a diagram that I call the picture frame, which helps understand how those combinations work together. So I see those ones most frequently, but the relationship pairing that I see longest lasting is between two rocks. And when I say longest lasting, I don't mean most successful. I just mean longest lasting.
Interesting.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And when we, because I imagine lots of the people that are kind of thinking about reading your book or have pre-ordered it or have got it kind of just landed are thinking about, you know, this is all about relationships with others, isn't it? Whether it's work, whether it's couples, whether it's friendships, whether it's family. If we are experiencing, and I'm just super conscious, obviously, of time, you know, we could talk about this for hours, but if you are really associating yourself with one of those profiles and you're listening to you describe them, you're like, oh, that's me, that is me to a T, and that is my partner, or that's my boss, or my sibling, or my mum, what can we do with the profiles? Because I think that's probably what people want from a conversation like this. They want to be able to go and be like, that's what I can do about it, apart from obviously, yeah, you know, reading the book and exploring, yeah, it a bit more. But one thing is bringing blind spots into awareness. So once we know, yes, we can do something with it, even though that might feel terrifying for lots of us, and I think that's, you know, we know, yeah, we all know as therapists how terrifying a first session of therapy for someone can be, or an inquiry email. You know, it's one of the things I never, yeah, ever doubt in my job, is how hard it can be for people to actually reach out. Yes. But what do we do with the blind spot information once we know it?
I suppose I would say two things broadly. One, we check ourselves. So if we know, let's say, for example, that I am a rock and I am a therapist, I need to be aware of that in my profession. I also need to be aware of it when I go home. I need to be aware of it as I am as a parent, as I am as a partner, as I am when I go into Sainsbury's, that there is something about my presentation that means I might be discounting how I feel, what I want, what I need. And there might be some information that's really valuable to me when I'm making decisions that I am excluding. So knowing that I'm likely to take a rocky position really helps me tune into what I might be missing. The second thing I would say is we really get to, and it's not about analyzing others, but we really get to understand where there's friction with other people for us. What is it about so-and-so that really irks us? You know, for me, it's been a fascinating journey where as much as my friends and loved ones are hustlers, I have found it really hard to develop some of that hustler myself. In fact, it's what I've been talking about in therapy lately. I am practicing colouring outside the lines. That's one of the things that a hustler can do beautifully. I say beautifully. That's one of the things a hustler can do. And a part of my rock has struggled with something that kind of looks chaotic or looks imperfect. So when I get to understand other people's process, I get to kind of take a leaf out of their book. Not necessarily the whole book, because there might be something they're missing too. There probably is. But I can start to piece together something that means I will check myself now and think, am I really bringing perspective to this? Or is there an option here where I could actually relax, bring my bridge to this, let things happen for a bit and find out how it feels? Is there something where I can bring my gladiator to this and step forward and say, you know what I need? When I get that, it helps me as a kind of shorthand just to run through my decisions. Am I bringing all my perspective to this? For me, it helps make the most intentional decisions, the most up-to-date, accountable, appropriate, fit-for-purpose, balanced decisions. And those are the decisions that are going to get me where I need to be.
And then in noticing some of these blind spots and these strategies, something you just said there really made me think that, are there certain times in people's lives that they might have kind of suddenly be aware of a blind spot? Is there a trigger for people realizing that? Something you just said there about the kind of colouring outside the lines of the perfectionism thing. For me, the process of becoming a parent meant I, by no choice, had to kind of let go of all of the, I suppose, order that I had tried to organise my life into. And I had to embrace the chaos to a bit, which I found incredibly difficult and really challenging. And, you know, I would say now I pretty much only exclusively scribble outside the lines rather than trying to keep it doesn't look neat and tidy anymore. Everything that used to be really perfect and neat look is long ancient history. But are there processes like that? So kind of parenthood, you know, mental health issues, menopause, you know, the death of a parent or a loved one. There's so much stuff I think that can throw huge kind of hand grenades into our lives. And I'm wondering if that might be, or you know, some a trigger for people kind of realizing blind spots or starting to think about their stuff. And I'm sure obviously there are kind of much less dramatic or kind of smaller versions of that. But I wondered if that's something that you're seeing or you're noticing.
Yeah, I think for sure. When I think back to actually my very first awareness of my blind spot, it was when I was driving down the A3. I worked for a company called Procter & Gamble. I worked in sales and marketing. I was so stressed. I was burnt out. I was in my 20s. And I found myself crying so hard that I couldn't see through the windscreen of my car to get myself to work safely. Well, that was really helpful to understand that there's a blind spot here. I don't think I could have got as far as I've got in my therapeutic journey had I not come up against this crisis, this burnout. What I thought was a breakdown was a breakthrough. For me, menopause has been something that has generated so much reflection in this area. You know, so many times we hear, don't we, that actually women particularly can be conditioned into meeting other people's needs. We're trained to do it. We get good at it. We're reinforced for it. We're praised for it. We go on, we become mothers. We become caregivers. We become parts of society. We have the tools. We communicate. We're empathetic. I get to menopause and I think, what about me? What about what I want? And that has really helped some of my inner gladiator come through. And it's helped some of my inner bridge come through as well to go, do you know what? That'll do. There's a real value in being able to do parts of all of these. But yes, bereavement, relationship breakdown, redundancy, a house move, a friendship that ghosts you out of nowhere. There are so many different triggers we can get to notice, huh, this thing that was working for me isn't working for me anymore. I need something else. I need to know what I'm missing. Why has it happened? And as much as the temptation can be, and how do I get back to feeling okay? Therapeutically, my intention is always, well, how can we go through that to actually understand so that you have all of these options available to you? You don't just have to get back to doing it the way you used to.
And then looking for the blind spot might feel like the more challenging thing, because why has that happened? What am I missing? I guess the temptation is almost always to be like, oh, it's about that other person. If it's someone else involved, oh, that's them. I'm gonna position the blame with them. You know, they got it wrong. They did this. We see that's such a common thing. You know, we all do it all the time, don't we? It's such a kind of part of the kind of human condition, is that we would much rather kind of criticize in someone else than access in ourselves. So is then the kind of acknowledging the blind spot or starting to look at this stuff actually often the thing we might not want to do or the harder option, because we then have to do the work on ourselves or and start to kind of unpick the stuff ourselves or actually look at our own stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, what you're talking about here is so important, because this for me is the definition of discipline. It's about knowing the difference between what I want now and what I want most. And what I want now might be to feel comfortable and for it to be your fault and for me to have done nothing wrong. And what I want most might be to actually feel more empowered in my life so that this doesn't happen to me again, so that I can make choices that protect me and others. So what I say to people often is, you're the common denominator here. And that is great news, because you can influence the common denominator of this problem. So if we cannot shy away from it, we can actually get that discipline that says, this is an opportunity. Genuinely, I feel more confident if I know what's going on than if somebody else has just behaved chaotically. That to me is terrifying. So I think once we start to get the results, and most of the time we get better results, then it becomes a kind of self-fulfilling work that we do.
Quite often I experience, and you know, have experienced in my life as well, is we feel like we're in patterns. You know, we're dating the same person again and again and again, or we're having the same experiences in our friendships again and again, or then, you know, why does my boss treat me exactly the same as that last boss when I left that job for that reason and I've ended up in a company and I feel exactly the same? Is that something about blind spots? Because we're the common denominator.
Yeah, totally. And I find that actually what's fascinating about that example, for instance, is the person who left one job and it followed them, you know, this negativity from a boss. And first of all, that might feel really disappointing. And then it feels quite liberating, because clearly then it's not about them, it's about me. It's about something I don't yet know. But once I know it, and often what we find out is, oh my gosh, there is this belief that six-year-old me had that said, I could never say no. And that's how I'm ending up here. Well, that's something I can work on. So there can be, I would say, liberation is the word here that I use, the idea of kind of finding out what the blind spots are and then overcoming them and leaving them in the past where they belong.
And that's the difference that you talk about between the known unknown and the unknown unknown.
Yeah. Exactly. And it was a conversation I actually had with Dr. Alex George, mental health ambassador, TV personality doctor, who said in A&E, things doctors are most afraid of are the unknown unknowns. And I thought, I'm going to take that, because that really resonates for me, that idea of we are afraid of what we don't know. Once we know it, okay, well, now it's up to us if we're going to do something about it.
Well, I mean, what a point to move into people's kind of questions on. And I've got some a kind of host of questions here. So one from Rita: thank Emma for talking through each profile with such clarity and offering the real life examples, of which there are a lot in the book, aren't there? There are lots of kind of profiles and examples in the book. If you want more of those, you can, because I think they give such colour. But the rest of the question is, do you come across individuals fitting more than one profile? And if so, how do we know which blind spots are dominant, as it were? And can I tack on to the end of this? Can they change profiles over time?
Great, great. Thank you, Rita. That's a really important question and something that I'm so glad we've come on to, because yes, people can be blends. I mean, I've used it kind of lightheartedly when I've talked about my bristle that I'm married to, but we can absolutely be different combination of blind spots. We can also be different profiles in different relationships. So some of the biggest gladiators at work come home and they're bridges. There's something about different spaces where they've been allowed to express themselves and then have to be invisible. Sometimes we have a blind spot that serves us when we're younger, that for whatever reason stops working. And so we grow up and we develop a different blind spot instead. And I see them change and flow in flux all the time. What I would say is that the one that feels least comfortable for you, the thing you want to do the least, that's the one to get most curious about, because that's probably going to be where you're going to feel the biggest shifts happen for you. A bit like me colouring outside the lines. If it makes me uncomfortable, that's probably where I need to look.
Okay, so maybe play, kind of learning to sit in the discomfort.
Totally. And get curious about it. You know, this is a word we use all the time in therapy, isn't it? It's like, just get curious about the, huh, isn't that interesting? When I'm in a meeting with that boss, my colleague responds in this way and I respond in this way. I would never say that. Why would I never say that? What is it that I'm projecting onto that that means that that's not for me? Just to start to have those kind of dialogues and also have them with other people. So interesting now, this kind of shorthand, and that's why I love a profile, that we get to kind of say, oh, yeah, that's you being a rock, isn't it? Okay, that makes more sense. I was taking it really personally as a rejection. But I see now that actually this is how it plays out for you when somebody brings too much vulnerability, for example.
I could ask you 100 questions first. There's never going to be enough time. Another question, how are these profiles different and or similar to personality profiling?
I think all profiling has that in common, that what we're trying to do is take this huge, infinite myriad ways of processing our thoughts, feelings and behaviours and structure them in a way that we can start to understand the patterns. So how is it similar? It's patterned. In terms of personalities, whether you're looking at strengths, Myers-Briggs, attachment styles, legitimately looking at just 17, maybe you're picking up a zodiac. There could be all sorts of ways that we use profiling to understand ourselves. I would say take the bits that appeal to you, run with them. Ditch the bits that don't. We don't have to fit into any of these profiles, but if there's something in it you think, oh, that's of use to me, grab it, take it.
So using it as a potential perspective or a lens to look through, but because I've often noticed if people have read books like Attached by Amina Bean, that they then come in and they say to me, oh my God, that person's that's that. And I'm like, okay, but take a step back, because it's a way that we can see the world, or a way we can see people, but there are obviously so many nuances to these things. But I think that for some of us, there's such safety in having an explanation for how we're feeling and what's going on, or why we're getting such a strong response to a person. And I think that that's kind of what you're saying here, isn't it? Is that we can use it to, we're using it to our advantage, but don't get so pigeonholed by it that we kind of lose sight of everything else.
Absolutely. For me, this is just access. You know, I was thinking about the work of Ware, who worked on Doors to Therapy, and I certainly used that as a therapist, or I did in the beginning, that idea of which is someone's target door, which is their trap door, which is their door that's going to be available to me. And it's just about using ways to chunk your thinking so that you can get further with something rather than just get lost in this maelstrom of infinite possibility.
Is there an advantage to trying to change your profile type? Oh, that's a good question. For example, rock or gladiator to another profile, or should we be accepting of the one that we are?
Spoken like a true bridge. I think actually what we're trying to do here is be the bits of all of them that are useful. And so I talk about how the bridge has great communication. I talk about how the hustler has great creativity. The gladiator has great confidence. And actually, the rock has great control. And just for ease, I've started each word with a C. So that there is something about recognizing that you don't have to change your profile. You'll have a profile. This is my belief. When push comes to shove, I will go back to rock. But so long as I'm actually in a space where I have a growth mindset, where I'm able to kind of learn and reflect and inquire, I can pick up all these really great bits of confidence and creativity and communication. And I can use those to my advantage so that I'm not just my starting point. So for me, it's all about allowing yourself to kind of reach out in different directions rather than hop from one to another.
So would that, an example of that be, for example, with trying to encourage the curiosity or the creativity, is a real life example, going and trying something completely new that you've never done before.
Yeah.
And just kind of throwing yourself into it and being like, that's a thing I would never book myself to do. But I'm going to try it. And again, it's that kind of just dipping your toe into.
Yes, absolutely. And just find out. And if you come back to me in therapy the next week and you say, well, that was absolutely rubbish, I will celebrate that fact with you just as much as if you say, yes, you know, I've found my calling, because this is all about discovery rather than decision.
Question from Claire. How do you switch or move from a rock to a gladiator? Is it about speaking up and stating your needs?
Yes. Is the simple answer to that. And I think where I'm actually at is I hadn't developed this way of looking at it when I wrote the book, but my lived experience now that I'm playing with it so much more has been that I have moved from Rock, I have moved to Gladiator, I'm now kind of playing with Hustler. My Rock to Gladiator move really chimed with perimenopause for me. It really was a moment of, hang on a minute, I do have needs. I do have needs. But given that I didn't have needs before, or so I thought, and I grew up with two Rocks for parents, the only way that I could actually get those needs heard was to really articulate them and say no, to put my boundaries in place. Some of those boundaries have actually moved again. I'm not being the demanding gladiator in my relationships. I'm working in a more negotiated, nuanced way. But I think if you want to make the leap from Rock to any of the other profiles and what they have to offer, your route is vulnerability. So find out what you need. Get kind of curious about your needs first. And then in the book, I talk about all sorts of non-conflict communication, how you can express them without necessarily having to be a gladiator and hit someone over the head with them.
And I suppose there are times in life where our needs completely change. For example, parenthood, for example,
yeah,
being unwell, for example, having an injury, or, you know, being put into a carer role. Or,
yeah.
And I guess that's why context feels so important in these conversations. We're seeing that could, because there might be something in our situation, in our life situation, yeah, that completely changes and pushes everything to a very intense dynamic very quickly.
Yeah.
And that is something that we kind of have to hold in mind, that those things, yeah, can completely change how we need someone or how we are needed.
Absolutely. And we have to be open to that. Of course we do. I think there's something about, I keep coming back to this word curious, don't I? But there's just something about, even then, notice what was the impact of that? How did that land for you? What do you want to keep doing? What do you want to stop doing? What do you want to start doing? Now you've got that information as well. We talk all the time, don't we, about rupture and repair. But this idea that, to your point about avoidance at the beginning, part of what people come to therapy to discover is rupture and repair. That we're not trying to avoid or eliminate any kind of confrontation, conflict or rejection. We're trying to learn how to be resilient and survive it. And in fact, improve our relationships as a result of authentic communication. So I think whatever crisis you might be facing, still allowing yourself to be authentic and true to yourself and congruent is going to really help you when you're learning that kind of resilience rather than elimination.
Mm. And we're so terrified of conflict so much of the time, and so many of us are.
And yeah,
avoidance can feel, well, we know, is one of the most natural strategies for managing anxiety.
Yeah.
And so I guess, yeah, sometimes it's about, as you said, leaning into that stuff a bit more and knowing it's okay to be a bit uncomfortable.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean it's great. It might mean it's absolutely rubbish to be a bit uncomfortable, but it's still survivable. And I suppose that's the bit that I talk about in the book, about this idea of how we can understand our brains as this mental plane with these long grasses, and that our brain just wants us to get from one side to the other as quick as possible because it's having a lot of thoughts. There's a lot of information coming its way. It will fly you across that path that you've trodden so many times before because it's nice and flat. It can see the path clearly. It might not be the most helpful, positive, useful, constructive thought. So for us to allow our brains to even consider that there might be another route, we have to keep coming back. Even when we find ourselves halfway down that path, come back to the beginning, put a foot anywhere else, somewhere else. As you start to kind of tread out these different options and alternative paths, the original one, the blind spot, will grow over. It will become less visible, less appealing to your brain to shoot you down. So I think if we can get through this idea that actually all of that elimination and avoidance that we've learned, we don't necessarily need it. There are other ways for us to make relationship that can include rejection and negotiation and distress and love and excitement and hope.
Mm. And we know the idea of neuroplasticity, the brain that changes, yes, itself, and neurons that wire together, fire together, wire together.
Yeah.
And I've got one final question, and I know because we've got literally a couple of minutes to go, but it's the perfect ending question. Is therapy necessary to uncover blind spots? And I guess what we'd probably say is we could just buy the book.
I love that answer. I think we'll leave it there. I love therapy. I'm biased towards therapy. I also am really realistic about the fact that therapy is not for everyone. It's not accessible to everyone. It's not necessarily something that will appeal or even be available if we wanted it. And even if we did want it, all those hoops and jumps you've got to do to try and get there. What I think is really important is that we do something about starting this conversation with ourselves. So what I'm not saying is read the book and you don't need therapy. That would be remiss of me. What I am saying is read the book and you will hear a therapist ask you the questions that they would have asked you in therapy. You will hear the stories of people who went to therapy and came to some sense of understanding about blind spots. And sometimes being alongside someone in their journey is a really good place to start.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think as therapists, we also need to be the ones sometimes that say therapy isn't for everyone. We know it's not accessible. We know it's not within reach, but also that like nothing in life is for everyone. Therapy yes. is another one of those things. But Emma, thank you. I mean, I loved the book. I identified very strongly with a few very uncomfortable home truths. But I honestly, I think it's brilliant, and it's out. Everyone, please go and check it out. But I think, like you say, the profiles, the explanations, alongside kind of real life examples of people actually living those experiences, and us being able to connect not just the actions and the behaviours, but the feelings with what people are describing, I think is a really, really useful way of kind of just being able to feel our way with it.
Yeah, feel our way. I mean, I think that says it all, doesn't it? Sort of feel our way rather than look at what we've seen for all these years. Thank you so much, Kate. I've loved this conversation and your questions. I really appreciate your time, and thank you everyone for listening.
Yeah, thank you everyone so much for coming along.
This episode starred Emma Reid Terrell and was presented by Kate Moyle. The producer was Georgia Athelsey, and I make the show with Nicole Wong. Our editor is John Doughty. Members of our How To Plus service were able to join Emma and Kate live and receive access to many more podcasts, videos and live streams with leading thinkers. How To Plus covers all kinds of topics, but it's particularly skewed towards psychology, neuroscience and well-being. So if you enjoyed listening, do take a look and use the code POD50, that's all caps POD50, for a half price discount. Until next time, I'm Vas Christodoulou. Thanks for listening.